All right, so today is January 28th, 2016. I am interviewing David Schoenbaum. I am Troy Reeves, and I'm here in Madison, Wisconsin. And we're doing a phone interview. So, David, where are you at?
I'm in what the developers call North Bethesda, Maryland, and the post office calls Rockville.
Okay, great. And this interview is being done to get some of David's stories and memories about his time here on campus, particularly being a Ford Scholar. So, David, the first question I ask is a pretty general one. Why come to UW?
Because the Herbert Howell and the Ford program came to me.
Okay.
I had applied to the Ford program with fantasies about the University of Chicago. I got accepted at the University of Wisconsin.
Okay. And do you recall when you first, well, I guess it sounds like then you didn't hear about the Ford Scholar Program. They found out about you.
I heard about it very late. I heard about it because our high school college counselor, an assiduous lady, had done her homework and was aware of it and followed me down the long corridor of our Milwaukee Urban High School, and I heard a voice behind me saying, "David, when is your birthday?" and realized that I made the cut by a couple of weeks, and she realized I made the cut by a couple of weeks, and entered me in the sweepstakes.
Now, David, from our pre-interview, by the time you matriculated here, you had already graduated high school, is that correct?
Yeah, I was of the 50, of the Wisconsin contingent of 50, I think I was one of two, maybe.
Okay. So, you said you had aspirations of University of Chicago, but ended up at UW. Had you been?
I never regretted it.
Good. Had you ever been to the Madison campus before you matriculated here?
Yeah, I think that someone had invited me to a football game.
Okay, so then not a lot of knowledge of the campus.
No association with the place, with the qualified exception of the Priority Quartet, which showed up from time to time in Milwaukee.
Okay. Do you recall then, as you came here to come to school here, what your initial impressions were first of the campus?
Well, it was big and exciting, and it was college with a capital C.
And I guess coming from Milwaukee, there it may not have been much of an impression of the town, but I wonder if you also got an impression of the city itself as you started going to school here.
Madison?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. It was, in some ways, of course, it was another planet, but it was only 80 miles away. It was smaller. And I got around on foot, and there were lakes on both sides, and there were hills to climb, and otherwise, and classical buildings in eclectic styles. But I can't recall I thought about it much.
Okay. I've heard from the other person I interviewed, and then just some background research, that getting housing for the Ford Scholars.
Herbert Howell apparently did heroic things and spent the summer, but I was a Wisconsin resident, and so I was eligible to live in a dormitory.
Okay, so which dorm did you live in?
Oh, God, one of the old bricky 1920s quadrangles. God, Trip, was, could that possibly be the place?
Yep. So,
Yeah.
So the one of the Lakeshore dorms then?
Yeah. Okay. One of the earlier ones.
Right. So you've talked a lot. Well, before we ask about the hows, let me ask about something I like to ask people of this time period, registering for class, because it's much different today than it is back when you did it.
Oh, it was done with punch cards, which I think they considered the absolute outer limit in modern technology. And so it was a great big, it was a kind of open market at the field house in those days. A lot of people milling around, a lot of tables, and they piloted you through, and that was kind of fun, as I remember.
Okay. So you've mentioned him a couple of times, but what are your memories of the Howes, maybe your initial meeting them.
Well, and particularly of him. I mean, well, he was this very tall, gaunt man who was probably in his middle 30s and an assistant professor, but at the time seemed to me a godlike figure of timeless antiquity. With a New England accent and granny glasses and a tweedy jacket, and that is a bona fide academic who was easy to talk to and knew a lot. And I was 16, and I looked up to him as surrogate, whatever, and he told us what to do, and I did it. He was terribly accommodating. He was a terribly nice man, and the then dean, I forget whose name slips me, who had the bright idea of recruiting him. It was an inspired idea because he was obviously the right guy in the right place at the right time.
Did you ever have dinner at the house, or did you get a chance to meet his wife?
One Sunday. But I needed it less than the others because I lived in the dormitory and my physical needs were pretty well accounted for.
Mm. So did you have a roommate at the dorm?
Yeah, for a semester or two, but then I moved into a single room and life got easier.
Okay. I was going to ask if it were, I guess if you could, if it was an issue with you being a 16-year-old with your roommate.
Yeah, no, I don't think it had anything to do with being 16. I was aware of being 16 when I was in high school. I was not aware of being 16 when I was in Madison, save as other people made me aware of it. It was no issue.
Okay.
It was alleged to be an issue. Perhaps others experienced it as an issue, but part of the experience was a sense of liberation.
Okay.
That I was in a place where I was not outstanding for being the youngest kid in the class.
Okay. David, did you, you talked about Dr. Howe telling you what to do and you did it. Did that mean that you joined ILS?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Where did that either?
You're cracking up a little bit there, David. So just to,
I haven't regretted that either.
Okay, so you did indeed join ILS and no regrets.
Yeah, and stayed to the end.
Okay. So does that mean you took specific, more liberal arts type classes in ILS?
Well, at the time, I aspired to medical school, so I did what was necessary in the basic sciences.
Okay. You've already mentioned a couple of times that you lived in the dorm and then eventually got a single room. I have a general question here about socializing on or off campus, particularly before turning 18.
I have no recollection of it, but I don't recall feeling alienated or at a loss for people to talk to.
Okay.
So I assume we drank coffee or we milled around or did something. But social life either was not a major factor in my routine or it took care of itself.
Okay. So during your time here on campus, I have some general questions about what you experienced, similar or different to other folks. So first off, are there classes that stand out in your mind?
Yeah, sure. The first semester, because of the classics department, it was a department of three. Howe was one of them, the junior member. Maybe there was a fourth, but in any case, it was a small department. And the two senior guys, Agard and McKendrick, were charismatic, as I've rarely experienced academics since. To the point that their lectures were applauded.
Wow. Any other classes that stand out beside the classes in the classics department?
Well, they weren't in the classics department. They were built into the humanity sequence of the ILS.
Okay.
They were the first semester. But, of course, that was a terrific introduction to college.
It sounds like it. So you mentioned a couple of professors there, Agard and McKendrick. Of course, you've talked about Howe. Are there other professors during your time that stood out?
Over the 4 years?
Yeah.
That is, I remember as distinguished or as interesting or as relevant. Gosh, I don't know. My respective academic advisors, I thought, were congenial and competent people. One of them was Justice Brandeis' daughter, Elizabeth, who had been a member of the economics department for some time. And, of course, I was, since I spent 4 years in the university orchestra, which in those days was almost a totally amateur enterprise, a few music students, I was aware of the conductor, who was a competent guy, whose name was Richard Church. And let me think. I had a bit of experience with Selig Perlman, who, of course, was a legendary guy, but I don't recall the class as particularly memorable.
Okay.
I'm hunting. Of course, I'll tell you, it made a deep impression on me, but he made a deep impression on me extracurricularly. And that was Jim Crow, the geneticist. But I met him as an amateur violist.
Mm.
Because he invited me, who for one or another reason was principal violist in the orchestra, he invited me to his house to play Mozart quintets with the grown-ups. And I was 18 at the time, and I didn't know things like this existed. And boy, I can tell you that that was a heady experience.
Yeah, so so performances within his home.
Well, I mean, just people play for fun.
Okay.
I don't know if that exists anymore. I doubt that it does. But he was still around. I hope you realize he was a member of the National Academy of Sciences at a precocious age, mid-30s. And before he died in his 90s, which is only a few years ago, he'd been elected to the Royal Society. And so he was as distinguished as it gets, and New York Times obit included. And so I remember him with great affection, not least because he was part of my college life and was still around until only a few years ago. As I say, he died at 95 or 6.
Yeah, I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think we did get oral history with him.
I hope you did, because he was a good talker, and he was just a very distinguished guy. So, and he was also involved in the early days of reconstructing fraternities with their exclusionary clauses. Mm. There was something, I think, called the 1960 Committee or something.
Mm-hmm.
All the fraternities on campus had to rewrite their charters by 1960 if they were to be recognized. I didn't do that. I had nothing to do with the fraternity scene and moved in the kind of ILS and post-ILS circle where we obviously felt superior to them.
Mm. We have 4.5 hours of interview with Jim Crow.
Yeah, good. Okay. Well, I'm glad you do.
Yeah, me too.
No, because I think, he spent a couple of years at Dartmouth during or after World War II, but otherwise spent all of those years, 50-some years in Madison, I think.
Yeah, we have him from coming here in 1948, so yeah.
Yeah, so the guy was a walking institutional history.
David, could we go back to the viola? I'm going to assume here, but if you can elaborate, when did you become interested in the viola?
Oh, I, got interested in the viola, I suppose, in high school because I thought it was a useful thing to learn. I'm a violinist by origin, and the viola is just a cognate instrument and useful for cognate purposes. And then when church needed a principal, he pulled me out of the first violin section and asked me to be principal violist.
Okay, so you started...
Incidentally, here I will contribute a Howe anecdote that church thought at some point relatively early that it would be a nice thing if we all played in tuxedos and I didn't own one. And at that point, Herbert Howe, who was twice my height and maybe half my weight, intervened and loaned me his. And so I played the concert in Herbert Howe's tuxedo with a lot of safety pins. I wouldn't have got through security at an airport with all those safety pins. And I still have a lot of regard and affection for a guy who loaned me his tuxedo when I was, I don't know, 17.
Mm-hmm. So did you know about the university orchestra before you got here?
No, I knew there was.
And then was it a matter of just finding?
No, I just finding... appeared. You know, I play. You know, I must. I assume I auditioned.
And was it just one principal performance each year, or was there a variety of performances?
Oh, no, I don't. I don't remember how many concerts. We must have played 4 or 5 concerts a year.
Okay, but it was this one at least that you had to be. In
tuxedo. Yeah, but then he found a windfall and used tuxedos and acquired them for the orchestra, and at that point I didn't need to borrow Herbert Howe's.
Hmm. Okay. David, what about your fellow students? Let's start particularly...
Well, I'll tell you who impressed me. Now I can reconstruct a bit of that, of course. And that was... peculiar to the era, and that was, of course, the Central European refugee diaspora, and they were represented on campus, and I guess I probably met all of them. Mossy, who was the youngest, Oscar Hagen, the art historian, who gave a good course, Rudolf Kolisch, of course, who was a legendary guy who was in the music school, and Hans Gert, G-E-R-T-H, the sociologist, who was kind of a gourmet item because his lectures were fascinating, inscrutable, and, you know, chaotic. But he was a Central European intellectual of the old school, and we all thought in those days that was terrific.
So since we're still on professors and classes...
Yeah.
What were some of the buildings, either that you took classes in, or at least the ones that you remember taking classes in?
God, I don't know, the ones that were there in those days.
So, perhaps Basque?
I suppose mostly the Basque Mill ones.
Okay.
Because I had no particular reason to hang out in the Ag campus. You know, at some point I had a job in Babcock Hall scooping ice cream, but that was not a class in any conventional sense.
So a bit more on buildings then. Do you recall where you would go then to study to prepare for tests or study to prepare for class?
I suppose my room or the library. They built a new library while I was there, and all pitched in and moved books from the State Historical Society into the new library building.
So when you were here, what's called Memorial Library was being built?
Yeah, no, it was open.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So David, let's talk about your fellow students, and first, perhaps, if there were Ford scholars that you... became sort of more than cohorts, but friends with?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, of those who are still around, John Israel was one, and Charlie Holbrow and his wife-to-be, Mary Ross, are old friends. I mean, going back to that era. I don't offhand recall that I had any particularly close relationship with any other.
Okay. Were there other students then, non-Ford scholars, that you built friendships with?
Yeah, I suppose that I must have met them, I don't know, living in the dormitory or something. Oh, a couple of ILS. Well, ILS, of course, was built to encourage this kind of bonding because it was small and intimate, and you saw the same people over an extended period of time with some regularity, and this was not the normal college experience.
So, were there spaces off campus where you would go either get a bite to eat or something that stand out?
Yeah, there was something. There was a pizzeria at the corner of University and Park that I remember. Of the Czech tablecloth and Chianti bottle. This is all decades before your time, so it probably won't ring any associated bells, but for anybody of that era, that would have been considered pretty romantic for Madison, Wisconsin.
Hmm. Any other places that stand out?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. The Rockefeller, I suppose, or the Union Terrace. Then as now, I would guess.
Okay. David, were you, did you attend church while you were here on campus?
No.
Okay. Was religion ever a part of your life growing up?
Well, in a very, in a pro forma, it was.
Okay.
But nothing of any particular relevance to the college experience.
Okay. You talked about being involved in the university orchestra. Were there clubs or publications that you were involved in?
I wrote for the Daily Cardinal from time to time.
Did you have a specific beat, if you will, that you wrote for?
Yeah, sure. They sent me to review concerts for a bit.
So anything other than the orchestra and the Cardinal?
Oh, I don't know, intramural softball or something.
Speaking of softball, one of the rituals on campus, you know, then and now, is attending athletic events. Did you attend?
No.
I think you alluded to this earlier when you talked about the Jim Crow's involvement in the changing of the fraternity charters, but mm-hmm. Were you involved in any type of campus politics?
No, not really. I was sympathetic. I suppose I was a fellow traveler, but I wasn't an activist. A few of my contemporaries, like Jane Ramsberger, whose father was a philosophy professor, went door-to-door canvassing for Joe Must Go, the McCarthy recall petition. But while I was sympathetic to that, I didn't do it.
So that sort of answers my question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because you were on campus during what's now called McCarthyism. So besides the fact you said you were a fellow traveler but not really an activist, did you see McCarthyism affecting campus in any way?
Yeah, well, minimally, because one of the things that impressed me then and impresses me even more in retrospect is that while it was easy to attack Harvard, it was much more difficult for him to attack the University of Wisconsin because it had a large constituency, and the constituency extended across the party lines. One of the most moving experiences of my life was a debate in that little lake shore lab. There was a biology lab, a marine biology lab, which was the venue for this encounter, God knows why. And it all had to do with the appearance on campus of an editor of what had once been the Daily Worker, was now the Weekly Worker, which is to say a guy who was invited by one of our Ford contemporaries, in fact, by Henry Wardus, who was probably the last living member of something called the Labor Youth League. And this so outraged a Republican legislator, that he wanted the university to take action and screen visiting speakers. And so this then came up for discussion at this curious encounter in that lakeside lab, where the legislator, who I think was a former Legion commander, thundered on about the danger of outside speakers corrupting us, and was blown away by another former Legion commander who was a Republican state senator from Whitewater, who stood there like the ghost of John Stuart Mill defending free speech and declaring that people go to college to meet ideas that they're not familiar with. And it was all terribly touching. I mean, unimaginable now, a Republican like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even both of them former American Legion commanders.
Right.
But this, and also, I mean, the guy from Whitewater, the state senator from Whitewater, had, you know, declaring emphatically that, damn it, that they were not going to lay fingers on his university. I mean, he was an alum, and that... That this is why McCarthyism didn't go very far.
Okay. I know I'm probably asking you a question that'll be difficult to answer, but I'd like to see if I could find, you know, any sort of Daily Cardinal coverage of that. Do you recall what year you were in school that happened?
Oh, I would guess it must have been 54 or 5.
Okay. Because John Israel mentioned that, too, and so I really should do some newspaper searching and see if I can find more about it.
I can't get any closer than...
That's fine. I can probably get it from there. Maybe, though, if you recall the time of year, was it, you know, like winter, spring?
No, I mean, I see it must have coincided with a legislative session, and so I guess it was spring.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense, if they were both able to come to this. All right, so now I just have some final questions. This one's, I'm guessing, is sort of obvious, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When did you leave UW and why?
Well, I graduated in 55, went to medical school, flunked out after a semester, hung around until the following year, doing odd jobs like painting the washroom at the Red Dot Potato Chip Factory, and then registered as an MA candidate in history. And so I was around until 57. By that time, I was the campus stringer for the Milwaukee Journal. Then left in 57 to take a job as a general assignment reporter in Waterloo, Iowa, and returned in time to submit an MA essay to an economic historian named Rondo Cameron, who was serving as my advisor in place of George Mossa, who was away that year.
Okay.
So I was around from 51 to 57. They were obviously the formative years of my life. I remember them with deep affection and have been living off the intellectual capital ever after.
Mm-hmm. So I assume once you graduated, you lived off campus then for a few years before you moved?
Well, last year of college, in fact, I moved into slum apartment no longer with us, long ago got blown away for the freeway, but across the street from Madison General Hospital. There was a street called Mound Street, and we lived in a slum apartment on Mound Street.
Okay.
Yes, my parents were horrified, but I somehow lived to tell the tale.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you want to note, you know, if you haven't already, that of the 50, only two of us were from Wisconsin. And
so the 54, the 50 Ford scholars.
Kid from Whitefish Bay.
So you're saying of the 50 Ford scholars, you and one other were from Wisconsin.
Only two of us were high school graduates. Only two of us were from Wisconsin. I was the only one who was both. And the other kid from Wisconsin, and I think this is noteworthy, was a black kid from Whitefish Bay, whose name was Marvin Chapman.
Did you spend time and get to know him at any point while you were both on campus?
Because he wasn't an ILS.
Okay.
No, I mean, we said hello, but there was we didn't intersect in any significant way.
Okay.
But what I do recall is that... That nobody seemed to find this remarkable. It's only now that I find it remarkable.
And by it,
you mean... this kid obviously made it long before anybody had ever heard of affirmative action.
Right.
And he must have been the only black kid in Whitefish Bay. And somebody obviously told him to... enter the sweepstakes as I did, and evidently his scores must have been adequate to get somebody's attention.
Mm-hmm. How often, or do you come back to campus since you left? After you left?
Well, since I spent 40 some years in Iowa City, I came back with some regularity en route to Milwaukee to visit my parents. And took kids along so they could see the place, and bought ice cream cones in the Union to consume on the Union Terrace. You know, did nostalgic things like that.
Okay. Did you ever attend any of the Ford Scholar reunions that happened later on?
No, I wasn't aware there were any.
I'm not sure if they were official reunions. I just know that there was a piece done for the Alumni Magazine in 2005.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. No, I was there. Yeah, I was there for that one.
Okay.
Actually. And then, what's his name with the Alumni Association, that he wrote a decent piece for the, whatever, on Wisconsin or whatever.
Yeah, John Allen, I think, is the...
Yeah, no, I was there. And we all had dinner at Dave Trubeck's, I think.
Okay.
Whom I knew slightly, and who left his marks because it was he who had been the Milwaukee Journal stringer, and in the middle of an intersection, I forgot what intersection, where we happened to meet, he asked me, he had to go away and be an ROTC lieutenant, and wondered if I would like to be the Milwaukee Journal stringer.
Okay. So that obviously was back during the 51 to 57 time period.
So this, yeah. I don't remember. I would guess it was 56 or 57.
Okay. So, final thoughts, if any, about the influence of being a Ford Scholar, or the influence of just being here at UW had on your professional or personal life?
Well, I mean, major, of course. College is a major experience. It was, I assume still is, a very good university. We were all aware that this was a very good university. Oh, there, another figure who, you know, had a cult following was the Russian historian Michael Petrovich.
Mm.
And so all of us had a feeling, you know, that we were doing something significant at a serious place. And you know, when you're that age, you don't really think long-term thoughts. You know, what do I do when I grow up? I suppose we all brooded about that. But in retrospect, I realized that this was a formative experience, and I learned a lot about how the world works, and met people I still know and like, and that's significant. I have warm memories of quite a lot of collateral things. I mean, the whole musical experience, obviously, was a pretty basic experience, and not to mention a way of meeting people. Mm-hmm. You know, first girlfriend, that's a basic experience. Learn to drink beer and coffee, at least coffee. At that point, I have no idea what it might be like for a kid today, but I would think that you have a better overview than I. That all of us remember it as a really important experience.
Did you? One more thing. Did you continue to play the violin or the viola after college?
To this day. Look me up in Google. I just published a large book with Norton called The Violin.
I will do that.
It's available from Amazon. It got nice reviews in the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung and the Washington Post.
David, is there anything else?
You know, and a lot of that is Madison-based. As I say, Kolisch was a significant figure. The quartet's violist, the quartet still exists in a notional way, and is incidentally worth your attention because it may be the longest existing string quartet on record. Because it goes back to its Belgian origins in World War I. That's the Proarti Quartet, okay, mm-hmm. which is still there, sort of.
Yep.
And that's now 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
That is obviously, you know, a pretty strange history, considering all the things that have happened in the meanwhile, but the University of Wisconsin, among its other innovations, invented the artist in residence in the late 30s.
Right.
Beginning with painters, then added musicians, and then acquired this Belgian quartet, which ceased to be a Belgian quartet, which eventually became a totally American quartet, and now lives, I think, on handouts, but I don't know if they have faculty status anymore, but still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an item in our life. I know what else I did. There was a good film society, and I was an officer in the film society. And I hung out with a couple of people who, one of whom went on to a rather distinguished career at Stanford as a film historian. Henry Brightrose was his name.
So I guess as I would understand the Film Society, that would mean that you screened films and talked about them. Is that correct?
Yeah, sure. No, they had a right, exactly. Yeah. But gourmet films, foreign films, the kind that didn't show downtown.
Mm-hmm.
16mm.
Was this all done in the?
And the organization of the university favored some seemingly, you know, kind of counterintuitive bureaucratic choices, that much of the arts enterprise was subsumed in the College of Agriculture because the Extension Division was in the College of Agriculture.
Mm.
And much of this, therefore, went on in the Extension Division. And so the Extension Division sent the Proarti Quartet on tour, and the Extension Division acquired a film library. I mean, all of this is quite counterintuitive, but at the time you didn't think about it, it just was.
Mm-hmm. And then I assume the films were shown in the Union?
Oh, God, I don't know where they showed, in classrooms or something.
Okay. David, I don't have any other questions. Do you have any other things that have come to mind since we've been doing this interview?
No, not. I think that we've pretty well touched everything that might be of interest. It's kind of anticlimactic. You know, I don't have colorful interviews about escapades or disasters or anything terribly dramatic. I suppose the athletic enterprise in those days was a little closer to reality than it is now. Mm-hmm. That is, that I recall sitting in Elizabeth Brandeis' economic history course with a football player. Mm-hmm. That's to say, football players evidently went to classes in those days.
Right.
Now that, thinking back on it, that is really a long time ago, right?
Right. Yes.
Boy, is that a long time ago, you know, student-athlete, you know, there was a certain pretense that student-athletes were students.
Well, David, I'm going to do the close here, and then I want to talk to you afterwards after I turn the recording off. So this concludes the oral history with David Schoenbaum. David, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay.